And welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I'm still Grace.
And I'm David.
Are you still Grace after all this time? I thought you were going to move on, be something else, try something new.
You'd be surprised. There's been a lot of changes. It's really amazing, really.
I don't know about you two, but I'm actually pretty psyched this morning because I just watched The Measure of a Man again, you know, just because. It's
yeah.
So good. Oh God,
it
so
really
good.
Is.
It's like, man, they got like there's like genuine chemistry between like Louvois, Philippa Louvois is her name. I don't know why that's so hard to say. And Picard, like they have like real like, oh my God, there's tension. It's great. Oh, I love that episode. Starfleet,
yeah, you're all
was founded,
fired up.
It was founded to seek out new life. Well, there it sits. yeah. You know, I love that episode.
We can tell.
That's not what we're talking about today. We don't have any emails, so we can skip right into part three of our reoccurring villains in Star Trek episode. I was not planning for this,
which
topic
has
to go.
Really gone on longer than we expected. Yes, not yeah, complaining, but still.
This topic about the reoccurring villains has just kept reoccurring and reoccurring on episode after episode.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Yeah, so like I wasn't planning for it to go this long, but it just turned out there were way more than I was thinking of. So for anyone who wasn't here the last couple of weeks, first week we did TOS and TNG. Last week we did Deep Space Nine. That of course took an entire episode because basically we had to list all of the Deep Space Nine villains. And
including
this week,
the Voles.
We are far too dedicated to Deep Space Nine.
Well, we do have a major vole infestation going around All Things Trek, but for now we're going to move on to Voyager and then Enterprise. You know, for a given value of recurring, we may find in Enterprise. We'll see. So for Voyager, I think the first recurring villain we need to consider is, of course, Captain Janeway. Do ho 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 ho.
Well, why not?
Was her hair
I really
stylist.
Do like that. Yeah, let's go with that. Janeway's hairstylist is a villain.
Well, I do appreciate that that the name of her first haircut is called the Bun of Command, like on Memory Alpha. And we talked a little bit over on like the Mythcreans podcast about how like there's always like a change in hairdos at some point in a Star Trek series to indicate the show is improving. Like in TNG, Riker grew a beard. In Deep Space Nine, Sisko shaved his head and grew a goatee.
In Enterprise, T'Pol actually it starts looking like a Vulcan with the eyebrows and actually the less shamp-looking hairdo.
Yeah, in Voyager, it's symbolized mainly by Janeway losing the Bun
Mo
of
Howard.
Command.
That's what I meant.
Say what?
If it was Shemp, she'd be bald.
Yeah. But, like, it's Voyager is symbolized by Janeway losing the Bun of Command and getting the Bob, I think is what that haircut is called, that she has
yeah,
for, like,
bob.
The lead. And the reason I joked about Janeway being a recurring villain is that because she's not very consistently written a lot of the times, it does sometimes seem like she's making decisions based entirely on what will cause the most conflict.
She is actively trying to kill the crew so that she can get home easier. She gets all the replicator rations.
And like, if you are looking at every episode of Voyager and trying to make them all make sense, that is one way to do it, is to assume Janeway is evil. And, you know, Kate Mulgrew plays great villains too, so I wouldn't necessarily be 100% opposed to that, but that was primarily a joke. Looking at the actual villains we have to deal with on Voyager, I think the first one, and arguably the best, is actually Seska.
Oh, hell yeah.
So
we could talk about Seska all day, and I'd be happy.
Well, we might end up doing that. So Seska
Holla.
First appears as a Bajoran Maquis, and I'm convinced that, like, they basically had her, like, she shows up in, like, two episodes, and I think that eventually they picked her to be a villain just because they had already used her once or twice, and they were like, people will remember who this is. Because, like, in the episode...
This is a name. People will vaguely remember that name.
Right, because the first two episodes she shows up in, like, she doesn't do anything special. She's just a Bajoran Maquis, and she has a name. Her name is Seska. And then, like, in the third one she shows up in, I don't remember the name of it. I should look this up. I'm professional. That's the one where she turns evil, and, like, suddenly she has this infatuation with Chakotay, and apparently they have a history. And she, like, steals some mushrooms from Neelix, and I'm all behind stealing from Neelix, and, like, makes him soup.
Whoa.
And so that seemed like it came a little bit out of nowhere. But of
yeah,
course,
it seems like they just realized, oh wait, we've got a female character who people know about and find vaguely interesting. Let's make her evil.
Yeah, or at least I'm not. It's not clear to me that her gender played a super important role in this. Although then again, she has this weird obsession with Chakotay, like with the whole "I'm going to have your baby." Like,
yeah, because apparently, so many problems with that.
Well, Jara says in the chat room that they never told Martha Hathick that she Hackett, Martha Hackett. Wonder if she can hack it. But that she was a Cardassian until she actually got the script for that episode, which makes sense because I didn't see any indication of that from her earlier performances.
No, which is kind of good because it means it's just kind of a surprise for the audience, but also it does kind of come out of left field.
And so all right, so let's talk about the troublesome aspects of this character. Her weird obsession with Chakotay to the point where she's like, "I stole your DNA and now I'm making a baby with it." Like,
yeah,
what's even happening there?
Yeah. Because apparently ambitious women are cray-cray.
Well, it's also just part of Star Trek's weird like obsession with ownership of your DNA. Have you noticed there are several episodes about that where Star Trek really hits home on this idea of like, if someone takes your DNA and does something with it, that's like really bad. That's like the worst thing that can happen to you.
Well, I mean, look at what goes on with DNA in today's world. So if we project that forward with, you know, increases in science understanding and increases in advances, I mean, in technology, that could be an actual concern. I mean, cloning in our time is not so great, but
or looking backwards, look at Henrietta Lacks, whose DNA was used in tons of medical experimentation and brought the pharmaceutical field forward decades and decades, and her family didn't even find out about it till recently. There was a book about it.
Right. So now project that forward with the increased science and technology, and then cloning is more stable and more doable in the future. So, I mean, that's the last kind of the thing is they don't have possessions, right? Picard and everybody have said they don't chase after wealth and possessions. So in a way, the thing that is uniquely you comes down to your DNA. And so
that's the final frontier.
There's ways, so many ways that people could, you know, get your DNA today, a strand of hair, saliva on a cup or whatever. I can imagine in the future it's even easier to get someone's DNA. And so it's like, you know, I wouldn't want to be cloned
just
a million
inhale
times.
Really strongly and you get their DNA sample.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, so I could see it being an issue or just brought up, you know. I don't think of it like, why does Star Trek deal with DNA so much? I mean, it could be a concern in that future timeline.
Well, it's not so much that I can't imagine it being a concern, because like it totally could be. It even is now. I mean, there's, you know, only very recently did the Supreme Court decide that you can't patent a human gene. Like that was a thing. I didn't realize that was a problem that we had, but apparently some companies were trying to do that. They were like, yeah, we found this gene, so we own it now. No one else can do anything with it. And it's like, but isn't that gene inside all of us? I don't think you can do that. So totally, like, there are definitely, you know, a number of issues related there. I just always found it amusing that, like, I'm thinking of specifically episodes like Up the Long Ladder, where the crew act like having their DNA stolen is like the worst thing that could possibly happen to them. And it's just like, you know, it's like one of those things where it's if this doesn't really affect your life directly, I feel like there are probably worse things.
It doesn't affect your life, but at the same time, it is a violation, and it is a very personal violation of the sense of self. I mean, your uniqueness is kind of plucked from you like that, right?
It's almost like today's world and going forward, the whole identity theft issue. Well, that takes it to a whole deeper level.
Yeah. Because it's a whole other level of identity theft.
Biological, you know, because everybody has a unique DNA from the two parents, and, you know, there could be a lot of good done with it, but then there could also be, like, you know, cloning Picard or, you know, people just trying to do, you know, weird things with your DNA that if you don't give it permission, then it's like, I think it was the Masterpiece Society, wasn't it, where they were all clones and they needed, because up the long ladder was the Irish, where they had like the hay and the goats and the...
They also had the clones. The Masterpiece Society is a little different. So Up the Long Ladder had the racist Irish stereotypes, and then it also had the Clone Society. And the clones were like, hey, can we have some DNA samples to maintain our society? And everyone on the Enterprise was like, no, God, no, no, that would be the worst thing ever. No, why would you even do that? And the Masterpiece Society.
So that's why they had to go. That's why they had to go, like, you know, pair up with the Bringloidy, the Irish people, to like infuse more DNA into their clone. And then, because then that was the second one I got confused with. Was that that's the one where they actually steal the DNA and they have to like kill their, you know, their cloning Riker and Pulaski.
And they straight up like murder the clones that are like, look like they're about like, you know, half a day away from being able to sit up and talk. And they just don't. It seemed a little odd. I've read that was supposed to be like a commentary on like abortion rights. Then that this was supposed to be an episode in support.
If that's what
like...
they were shooting for, I think they missed.
Yeah.
Right. That was sort of my thing, was that I was looking at it, I was like, if this is supposed to be an endorsement of abortion rights, it's a really bad one. Like, as a supporter of abortion rights, I do not think this episode is working in that regard. But reeling it back a little bit, you know, I'm pulling it back on the fishing line here, back to Seska. Jara also made an interesting point, and I'm just going to read what she said in the chat room. I do think it's important that it was using her reproductive ability to hold something over both Chakotay and Kala, playing on men's apparent anxiety over paternity and women having control over that part of the process. Which is, that's a possibility. I could see that. I was unclear if this was... like, if Seska was supposed to have a plan when she did that, when she was like, I'm going to impregnate myself with, like, you know, was she planning to use the baby to lure Chakotay back for some reason? Or was that, like, and if so, why did she, well, I guess maybe she needed to tell him about it. I don't know.
Well, have you ever heard of, this isn't a phrase I like to use, but it's a phrase that has been used many times in the debate against people who are trying to immigrate to the United States. The phrase anchor baby gets used, wherein the idea being that someone will have a baby in a country, and since that baby will have citizenship in the country, that will keep them there. And sometimes you hear stories about women doing that in relationships, like having a baby to keep someone with them, or to try and make them think, you can't leave me now. That's kind of the creepy vibe I got off the whole Seska thing. Like, because she knows Chakotay will not walk away from his own kid like that. And that just added more to the whole unnecessarily crazy bitch vibe that I got with some of the writing for Seska.
And just in one, like you said, to go like a little attachment to that, it's also just a major manipulation. You know, like you could totally, whether he's going to embrace this,
and it makes
the
her friggin' evil, yeah.
Right.
Kind of wonder what her plan was if he had decided, whatever, I don't care. Not my, you took my DNA. I'm not part of that.
Well, from day one, we know that Chakotay isn't the kind of guy who's going to do that, though. I mean, he's many things, but just being like, no, I'm going to leave this baby behind is not one of them.
That's true. And and Seska's other problem, I think, is that she, for some reason, they decided to pair her with the Kazon, which are just kind of poorly conceived villains to start with. And so, like, now Seska has to try to be threatening, armed with like the wet slipper of Star Trek. It's like, you know, it's like these aliens, like, their concept was kind of like space biker hooligans, I guess, was what they were trying to
go
for.
With tree hair, yeah.
Yeah, with, like, rocks in their head. I don't know. It's very, very odd. But, you know, despite that, she manages to do a fairly good job. She actually gets the better of Voyager on a couple of occasions. Now, granted, part of that is because Voyager is incredibly stupid sometimes. Like, when they're like, hey, this is a probe that is sending out a Starfleet code. That doesn't make sense. I wonder who would be around that would send out Starfleet code. Oh, it was Seska. Okay, that makes sense. And, of course, and then they use that to get the better of Voyager. But on the other hand, like, you know, the whole way they took over the ship in Basics, that actually was pretty interesting.
Also, Jiminy Cricket is in love with her, apparently, which is weird.
Wait, what? Say that. Say what?
Seska, the guy who's like on the ship feeding her information at one point. Jiminy
Oh,
Cricket from
yeah.
Once Upon a Time.
Is that Jim? Oh my god, that explains why I hated him so much.
It's Kaden! It's Kaden, man!
Huh. All right. Well, interesting.
I remember, like, the
Further
whole.
proof that he is the worst. Dio is the worst. The worst!
Kazon, I kind of. I didn't like them, of course. I mean, just the way they were executed. But I did kind of like the idea that they're not, you know, a planetary government. You know, like we've been seeing dealing with, you know, the Klingon Empire, the Klingon military, the Romulan Star Empire, the Cardass. So here is this group that is more just like a, like you said, a biker gang or just a rogue association or whatever, like space pirates. I just didn't think they were executed that well. But then having Seska associated with them. At first, I thought, okay, this kind of makes sense. You know, she would get associated with a group that she could give her ways and means and resources and that she could manipulate and control. I was just always hoping that once, because I knew that wasn't going to last forever, I was just hoping that she would outlive the Kazon storyline. And it's just, to me, it's sad that they didn't continue using her. Like, okay, her dealings with the Kazon would fall apart or whatever. But then she can move on to the next group of aliens and kind of have a running character that's not part of the crew, but it's part of the show as a long term. But because I just liked Martha Hackett, she played a cool Romulan on DS9. She played a very cool Klingon in the Star Trek Klingon PC CD-ROM game. So she's just a good actress and character. But I was hoping to see more of Seska for a longer period on Voyager.
Yeah, I was really bummed that we didn't get to see more of a long-term plan from her and see her grow more as a villain. We just kind of got. It was a straight shot from the beginning, really, and disappointed me a little bit because she really was an interesting character.
Well, and that's part of the weirdness of it too, is that it kind of begs the question of like, how did they? One thing that I've always wondered about is because we see Seska like over and over again, and I always wondered how is Seska keeping up with Voyager, like because Voyager is flying like away from them at like warp 9, and I always got the impression Kazon ships weren't very as fast as Voyager, so I'm trying to imagine like. Is there like a great Kazon migration just following Voyager wherever it goes? Because they sort of gave the implication that this was all still in Kazon space, but like apparently they stuck around for a while. So it
It's like
seems kind of.
tailgaters. They're just following them along. They're like tracking them while they're on the road. Like
Well,
football fans.
that's the kind of idea that I had for that they could have used for Seska was that. She didn't want to be part of the crew, right? She didn't want to join Voyager, but at the same time, she would have a similar goal of getting back home, getting back to the Alpha Quadrant. So it could have almost been like, aside from a revenge issue or, you know, her wanting to actually, you know, attack Voyager, there could have been elements where over the seasons, she's like super villain, you know, number one. And then at different times, she's kind of more like Garak, where it's like, do you trust her? Do you not trust her? Because she tried to kill you
Right, it would have been
before.
really interesting to see the level of versatility that that character had the potential to have.
Right, and then she could go away for half a season or a whole season and then come back, and then you just get the idea like she's shadowing Voyager, but also going off doing her own thing, her own, like, you know, adventures or trying to get, you know, power, resources, whatever. And then she pops up again, you know, around the Voyager crew again because, you know, they're the ones going to her same, you know, destination. They would take different tracks or whatever, but. Otherwise, she would just be like, I'm just gonna chill out in the Delta Quadrant, but obviously she was like she would want to get home. So it would just be like a thing where you, on some cases, you don't want to trust her, but she has something that would benefit Voyager, so then you kind of do a shady deal, but like and then it's like and then it would be even more interesting if on occasion she did help Voyager. And then that would make the Voyager crew like go, you know, head spin. Like, she tried to kill us. Now she's helping us. We don't understand what's going on. And then she's back to, you know, trying to exploit Voyager. It would have just been interesting because she did seem like a character that could do schemes and plots and, you know, intelligently manipulate people and groups or whatever to where she could have been one to be like a shadow figure, like shadowing Voyager, following, and then pop up and disappear and then come back around.
You know what would have been interesting? You know what they could have done, I think, that would have worked very well with the backstory they established, is instead of having her like run to the Kazon when she was revealed to be a Cardassian, she could have been like, "Hey, I'm a Cardassian. I claim the protections I'm due as the citizen of a foreign power,
Oh,
Voyager.
hey,
I,
that
you
would have
know,
been cool.
you know." And then she would have had this weird like status on the ship where like they couldn't just leave her, because that would be, you know, leaving a Cardassian in the middle of other people's space, and that would be probably against the Prime Directive. But she's also not part of Starfleet.
Well, we all
Like,
know how much Janeway cares about the Prime Directive sometimes.
sometimes a lot, sometimes not. And so then, you know, that would have been interesting. That would have given them a reason to keep her on the ship, and she could have like stuck around, like David was saying, as a foil, and maybe worked her way up to being a villain eventually. I don't know. I think I would have liked that. I mean, I guess I really would have liked anything more than her going to hang out with the Kazon, because she was so cool, and the Kazon were so not worth her time.
Well, that's why when I was watching through the series like the first time, wondering like where are they going with this, I always thought of it as she was using them as a stepping stone, like, you know, not here's my ultimate home, or here's, you know, the people I want to trust with my life, or ultimately whatever, but like using them as a stepping stone. Once they no longer suit her needs or can provide her with what she wants, she would dump them and move on to the next group. And so once the storyline ended and she was just gone, I was like, oh, that's too bad. You know, I liked that character and the actress, so I would have wanted to see her, you know, manipulate the next group of whatever aliens pop up in the Delta Quadrant.
Would have been interesting if she'd like gotten her own ship and kind of been following Voyager. I don't know. I'm maybe like, and at that point, maybe it would have been one of those things where instead of, okay, so we're like totally just engaging in theory crafting here, but that's fine. I'm gonna do it anyway. If we had,
Something new and different.
if her instead of trying to destroy Voyager, she had like acquired another ship and then also been trying to get home because that was her goal, and they would have been basically along the same flight path, and they would have run into each other sometimes, and then we could have had tension over Seska being like, "Hey, I'm here exploiting these natives or whatever. I'm here doing something bad to speed my way home." And Voyager could have been like, "Well, maybe we have to do something about that." And it wouldn't have been Seska just constantly trying to destroy Voyager, but it would have been they would have come into conflict over like their competing morals. I think that would have been interesting. Although we should
Yeah.
also, yeah.
Well,
We did
especially.
kind of get an episode like that, but it wasn't great. Except in there was no Seska also.
Which one are you thinking of?
The one where the people are like, "Oh, hey, there are these little happy demon smoke creature thingies. Oh, wait, we can totally power our ship with them."
Oh, yeah,
Those guys.
Equinox. Yeah, that would
The
have.
ones with Evil Doctor.
Yeah, that would have been legit. You know, Equinox. Not so good ideas. We should also remember that in addition to the thing she did when she was alive, there was a Seska episode after she died. Do you guys remember that one?
Yeah,
No, I don't.
vaguely. I remember, like, and I just looked it up. I mean, it triggered my memory because I looked it at her up on Memory Alpha, and it says Seska hologram from worst case scenario.
Yeah, so Grace, you haven't seen this episode yet, but it's a pretty good one, I think. It's granted it's a holodeck malfunction episode, which is always kind of annoying, but it's at least done on purpose. Basically, the premise is that
Interesting.
you know, they discover this old training simulation that Tuvok had, where he was like, "What if the Maquis, you know, mutinied and tried to take over the ship?" Because apparently Tuvok didn't get the memo that the Maquis were going to assimilate like instantly. So, you know, he thought they might try to take over the ship. And then Seska got into this program and apparently being very foresighted, knew that she was going to need revenge on the Voyager crew, and so programmed it to malfunction and kill everyone who was inside it once Tuvok went back in. And so they have
Maybe
this,
it wasn't even foreplanning. Maybe she was just hoping to mess with it at some point in time. It wasn't revenge, it was just her being a jerk.
that's possible. We don't know. But it's a pretty good episode, and I really kind of I admire the idea of Seska reaching out from beyond the grave to still cause them problems. I thought it was a fun episode anyway.
You really can't keep a good bitch down, I guess.
Nope, not really.
Was that the one where because she was a hologram, the doctor, who you know, obviously is also a hologram, they had like the Mortal Kombat style fight where their fist just turned into a giant hammer and her fist turned into a giant, because, you know, they're holograms.
Damn,
they can morph their...
That sounds awesome.
I'm sorry, Grace, this did not actually happen. David is making stuff up. He is being a liar pants, which is dishonorable, David. So
wishful thinking.
Unfortunately, no, that isn't what happened, but it's still a fun episode. I still liked it. And so do you guys have more you want to say about Seska, or shall we go on to the other reoccurring villain of Voyager? I guess there are two more, technically speaking.
Well, I mean, like you said, we could talk about her and speculate and wishful, you know, creative thinking, but just basically that she's awesome, even though she's a villain.
We like her. We would have liked to see more of her.
Yeah, even though she's not on, you know, on the good guy side or the Voyager, she's good at good character, good actress. We wanted
she
more.
Was just too fabulous to last.
So the opposite of all that is, of course, Maj Kala, who is basically just a waste of screen time. And it really, like, skeeves me out that they decided that he and Seska were actually having sex, because they, like, retconned. Because I didn't actually see any evidence of that, like, at all. I just assumed that he was allowing Seska to stick around because he knew he needed her, because he, like, on some level he recognized how pathetic he was, and he needed Seska to, you know, keep him in his little Nistrum, that was the name of his sect, I think, afloat. But then they retconned it because the baby that Seska had was, they needed it to not actually be Chakotay's, because they realized that, like, there was no way Chakotay would just leave the baby, and they weren't prepared to have a baby on Voyager, and they weren't prepared to kill a baby. So they had to retcon it to be Kala's baby, even though that was clearly not the indication from earlier episodes.
So a baby is saved by stupid writing.
Yeah, so gross. I didn't know. I don't know. I hate Maj Kala. I hate Maj Kala so much, because he's like, he's so stupid. He's like just the personification of everything wrong with the Kazon. Like, he's all about...
Remember how we were talking about Bull Dukat, and there's like that figure who personifies the race and all of the problems with it and all of the interesting things about it? Yeah, he's like that, except with crappiness.
Yeah, pretty much. And like, he clearly does not seem to understand that without Seska,
he's the Mark Alamo of terribleness.
Oh, you can compare him to Mark Alamo. It's rude, Grace. Very rude.
Mark Alamo at levels of excellence, but, you know, flipped over to terribleness.
We've inversed the character talent build.
Exactly, the inverse Alamo theory.
That's good, I like that. We can write that down. We can submit that to a scientific paper. The only other thing I guess really I have left to say about Kala is that it's like, not only is he really stupid from the writing, but like, it seemed like just everything, in addition to the way he's directed and acted, is just designed to make us, like, wonder why he's even here. Like, he doesn't seem to, he has no grasp of, like, basic tactics or strategy. He's always, like, trying to do the stupidest thing possible, and Seska has to be,
he's
like,
he's just
no,
there to be the mustache-twirling villain while Seska's kind of trying to keep it together.
Yeah, I guess it's supposed to be, like, he's supposed to be scary because he's so, like, sexist and rude, but really, he just kind of is like, man, you are a waste of time. Just leave.
Well,
just
that's kind of, in the beginning, that's kind of what I wondered if it was the intent or not, or if it just, you know, worked out in a way that I looked at the Kazon almost like you said, almost, you know, I never thought of it that way, but it was a good analogy or image of the biker gang. Because I kind of thought in Star Trek, we've seen the grand empires, right? Klingons, like I said before, Klingons, Romulans, Cardassians.
I know, but just take the potential of the idea of the Hell's Angels of space. That could have been freaking amazing. And it wasn't. We got the Kazon.
Well, right, because I kind of thought of them as, now Voyager is trying to get home, going through this uncharted territory, and they're going to run into danger and stuff. But when in this case, aside from it being like a giant empire, like they ran into the Cardassians or the Borg, now they're dealing with like the petty thugs that are kind of small time compared to, you know, those giant governments and empires that are like, you know, interstellar, you know, big players, like, you know, government level. But now they're dealing with this, you know, this rogue faction of just space pirates or the space bikers. They're petty thugs, but at the same time, there could be those that are, they are like petty thugs, but they're still dangerous enough that you can't just, like, you know, scoff at them and then just, you know, slap them down quickly and easily and get rid of them, because they're, you know, they've been there for so long, they're entrenched into that territory, that it's like, you know, it was kind of like, they're not the most grandest schemers, they're not the ones that have political influence over, you know, other people and treaties and whatever. It's like, they're just the petty thugs that now you have to, you know, worry about, because they actually are dangerous enough to like take people down, kill them. And so, and then I was hoping that they would turn into something more and better over time, but it just, they kind of stayed as what they were.
Again, it was kind of a straight shot from point A to point B with no real change.
So, looking at something that does change instead, which is not necessarily good, but at least is interesting, the other recurring villain that I could think of for Voyager would be the Borg Queen, who is, again, I'm not, like, you know, I've talked about before how I'm not crazy about the idea of the Borg Queen in general. Like, when it was introduced in First Contact, I didn't think it was necessary, and then, like, you know, she kept popping up in Voyager, and it's sort of like, I just don't like the idea of a Borg Queen. I prefer the Borg when they were a collective, and now they're kind of a dictatorship, which is a little bit, like, just sort of, you know, takes away from their alienness, you know, a little bit. But the Borg Queen, she has a couple of good episodes, in particular, sort of, the way that she, what helps, her biggest asset, I think, is showing us something about Seven, because, like, we've talked before that despite some of her, some of the characters' problems, like the outfit that is really stupid, Seven is still a good character, and we get some good development of her from the Borg Queen.
And I think the Queen really does serve as the sort of foil to Seven of Nine in a way, and the whole, you know, this is what Seven of Nine could have been, and now, you know, but she's actively trying to be a person. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I was more thinking of, like, there are certain episodes, like, I think Raven is one of them, or maybe Dark Frontiers. There are a number of episodes that involve the Borg Queen and Seven, and I can see what they were trying to do with the Borg Queen, where they were like, this villain will be someone who can, like, sort of stand opposite Janeway and, you know, be a force of personality, as it were. Because a lot of shows have done very well with that, right? And, like, Deep Space Nine, we talked about, had Gul Dukat. But, like, someone who could be the major antagonist, for not just, like, a reoccurring bad guy, but someone who would be, like, the big bad of the series. But I think there are too many unanswered questions about the Borg Queen. That's what bothers me about it, is like we never learn why she's so obsessed with Seven in particular.
No,
like,
we really don't. It's just kind of like, it's because she's a primary character, and that's why we're supposed to care, and that's why this character is supposed to care.
Yeah, it's like, because Seven was freed from the collective, that the Borg would be obsessed with getting her back, but she's hardly the only one. They actually established quite
a few. See, like, that whole little commune of freed Borg and stuff just earlier in Voyager.
Yeah, and then, like, there's, of course, Picard, and then there are the Borg kids, and then there are a number of other ones over the course of the series.
Hugh,
definitely, and, like, all the other Borg from Descent, because they didn't go back to the Collective. We actually never learned what happened to them. That would have been an interesting episode. But for some reason, it's Seven of Nine, and the Borg Queen, like, passes up numerous opportunities to destroy Voyager, and I can only assume the reason she chose not to destroy Voyager was because she didn't want to kill Seven. Because that's
but
the only
why doesn't she want to? That's what we still don't know.
Like, why is she willing to take all these risks to get Seven? That is a bit of a problem. Now, that said, I do appreciate a lot of the acting that went into the Borg Queen. I don't remember the names of the various actresses who played her, but for the most part, I thought they did a pretty good job. So I just want to make that clear. My complaints with the character have more to do with the way she was written and not the way she was portrayed on screen. Oops, sorry. I think I messed up on my tabs there. But okay, so that I was just like, all right, I'm going to press control and talk, and then, like, all my tabs disappeared. But
oh dear.
Yeah, I know, right? And I think I will give the Borg Queen credit for one thing, which was in Endgame, which I guess you haven't seen this one yet, Grace, but the last episode of Voyager, again, it has problems, but I do appreciate the dialogue between the Borg Queen and, like, old-time Janeway. Like, because Janeway comes from the future to save the past or what have you. And so you have two Janeways, and one of them is old. And at one point, old Janeway gets captured by the Borg. And, you know, I think they have some very good dialogue there. So that's, you know, I could see they what they were going for was this, like, that's why I think the idea of the Borg Queen was this someone who was supposed to be able to, like, match wits with Janeway. But I think the reason it didn't work very well was because, again, the Borg Queen, despite being very human in the way that she interacts, is still the head of the Borg. So there isn't really much of a reason for her and Janeway to ever meet. Or at least that's what it seems like to me.
Yeah, I'd go with that. I'd go with that.
I guess there wasn't really that as much to say on the Borg Queen as I thought. Do you guys have any notes you want to make on her before we move on to Enterprise?
Not really, but I don't have much to say about Enterprise either.
Yeah, I guess we'll go on to both series, Voyage, that Grace hasn't seen all of. David, what about you?
Basically, there was the whole motivational question and you know, some of the story holes or just story weirdnesses of it. But I did enjoy seeing the Borg Queen again. And it was Alice Krieger who played her in the movie and came back the second time Voyager showed the Borg Queen. The first time was Susanna Thompson as the Borg Queen on Voyager. I kind of was disappointed. She did it like a good enough job, but I remember at the time thinking, oh, it's too bad they didn't get, you know, Alice from the movie. So then it was cool again the second time that she did come back and do it for Voyager. But I don't know. I haven't spent like long time thinking about all the permutations and questions about it, but over the course of, you know, just here and there, I kind of thought, because I remember thinking, well, how come we didn't see anything about a Borg Queen when Q first introduces them and all that? But then I started thinking, Starfleet, and especially like the Enterprise, but, you know, Starfleet, they started tinkering with the Borg. And so maybe that caused them to create the Queen, or the Queen just like emerged out of the collectiveness, out of the collective because of all the stuff that was going on. We had the Enterprise trying to put in that code or the virus. Then Lore was messing around with them. And so maybe that was like, you know, an outcropping or just a reactionary thing where the collective didn't start off with a Queen, but then after dealing more and more with Starfleet, Enterprise, and Lore and everything and all that, that here comes, you know, it affects them, the Borg and the collective, and so here comes a Queen. But then it was like, again, why was she so focused on Seven? Because, you know, at first you could think, oh, it's because she's liberated. But then there's basically, you know, what we were all just saying. So I was just kind of more curious and having like unanswered questions about the character. But over the course of the episodes, I enjoyed those episodes and, you know, thought it was cool that they used her again.
And I guess the question you have to ask is, would those episodes have been better or worse without the Borg Queen? Because the first episode, or the first real Borg episode, you know, not counting the one with that like separated collective, I don't remember the name of that episode, but the one where Chakotay meets some Borg drones who are doing their own thing. But the first like real
the
Borg
commune one, yeah.
Yeah, the Borg commune. The first like real Borg adventure is in Scorpion, and the Borg Queen doesn't feature in that episode, but that's like widely considered to be the best Borg episode in Voyager. So I feel like maybe they would have been better off with just the faceless collective. But I mean, maybe not. I thought it was interesting, David, that you brought up the idea of her being something that was like created in response to all the shenanigans that happen in the show. And of course, the problem with that is in First Contact, they show flashback sequences of her being there during Best of Both Worlds, which is just kind of dumb. But I would certainly accept your theory better than what they actually showed on screen. Now, of course, the last thing that we have here, let's see. I've got some interesting comments here. I'll just go ahead and read what Jera put in the chat room, because for funsies. She says, I liked the way she was going after Seven and Janeway in the same way she did Picard and Data. Made it harder to see as a stereotypical vamp situation. Because there's no arguing the Borg Queen didn't have a sensual sexual overtones in how she approached these people. Yeah, and that's true, just down to her costume, which again struck me as odd that the Borg would create such a highly sexualized costume. Maybe they knew they needed to attract ratings. Who knows? They had assimilated the Nielsens by then, so they knew what was up.
Well, she was going after Picard. Remember when Q said that if Q had known all that what he knew, he would have appeared to Picard as a female Maybe they're like, you know, we need to entice Picard. I don't know. It's weird. And that was part of the thing. Like, how come she's like, in one hand, I remember thinking, oh, that's a cool costume. She's hot in a Giger, H.R. Giger kind of way. But then I at the same time, I started having a thought, like, if she's the queen of the Borg, look at, like, the Aliens movies with Ripley, right? We got the aliens, and then the queen is, like, bigger and gnarlier and meaner looking. So I kind of thought it would have been weird if they went with the alternate approach of making the Borg queen be, like, more gadgets and, like, forearms coming out instead of, like, you know, like, more gadgets, more wires, more blinky lights, like, to make it the biggest, baddest Borg. It's like, that could have been trippy and weird.
So she could have been a boss fight? Is that what you're saying?
Basically, yeah.
Of course, someone else pointing out in the chat room that they'd rather have Seska and the Borg Queen than listen to Neelix, which is fair. I think we can all agree that Neelix is the real recurring villain of Voyager, poisoning the ship with cheese and such. Now, of course,
and creepy relationships.
So now we're in sort of the last couple recurring characters of Star Trek, because Enterprise wasn't very big on continuity either. So the first thing they tried to have for a recurring villain was this guy named Silic. And again, Grace, I don't know if you've even watched enough Enterprise to know who Silic is.
Nope.
So Silic is he's a member of the Suliban, who were, you know, again, kind of poorly thought up villains in the first place. They perform terrorist acts and they get paid in biological enhancements that allow them to perform more terrorist acts. So it was their motivation was never entirely clear, but basically he's just a recurring Suliban and he is like around, but he was never like, they never just developed much of a personality for him. And like, ironically, the best episode he's in is the last one, and that's Stormfront, which is the episode where they have time traveling Nazi vampires from space. And he's like, in that episode, he appears like he's in disguise, quote unquote, like as a human, but that's just his actor without all the Zindi makeup on, or not Zindi, excuse me, all the Suliban makeup. And that's the best episode he's in, and he and Archer have kind of like a couple of moments where they're like old enemies that have kind of grown respect for each other and now have to work together. And I'm like, that's cool, except that's not what actually happened in the episodes, because like Archer and Silic like don't interact very much, because like Silic, again, he's sort of there, but he's not really ever really established as being very strong. David, do you have anything to say on Silic? Because like, I don't think Grace can render too much here, being as she hasn't seen these episodes.
Yeah, no.
Well, I mean, in a way, not much. Basically, what you were saying, because I've only seen those episodes probably once each. But I remember like wondering if that guy was going to turn into like, they're going to develop that character to be like a big, you know, a reoccurring either villain or antagonist, or you know, just a thorn in the side that they have to keep dealing with. But I remember wondering like, is this going to turn into, you know, one of the rogue, you know, basically like one of the rogues gallery of, you know, the bad guy of a bad guy collection of Enterprise. But then they didn't really go too far after that.
Now, of course, there is always Combs and his character, but
Combs!
By whom,
yes,
I mean,
yes, please, yes.
Well, no, by which I mean, what's his face? Shran, played by Jeffrey Combs. But we've already talked about Shran. We've had like an entire episode about Jeffrey Combs and how he's kind of
we can talk more about Shran. We can talk about Shran all day.
Well, it kind of goes back to, is he a full-on 100% villain, or is he like just the antagonist? Because there were times he was seeming to help Voyager. Then it went back to him like sabotaging or like being against them. So it's like, is he a full-on, like, you know, 100% villain, or just somebody that you don't really know if you could trust or not, and will work against you if it helps them, but will work with you if it helps them? Like, it's kind of a weird character, but in a very awesome way.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously we really like him. I don't really consider him a villain. I consider him more of a foil, because for the most part, he and Archer are only really in direct opposition once. For the most part, after that, it's kind of just an uneasy relationship. But one recurring villain that Enterprise has who is actually pretty cool is Degra. who is the Zindi primate who is working on the weapon. And like all of the Zindi, he has a bit of a motivational issue of like sort of blindly following this person who says that they should blow up an entire planet. Like that's kind of an extreme thing to do. But even with that, he does have he's surprisingly well characterized. Like they go to a lot of they go to a fair length to make him more interesting and give us more interaction with him. And there's an episode, I don't think we've gotten to this one, Grace, but it's an episode where they actually capture Degra and then they like put him in like a shuttle and trick him into thinking that like he and Archer are like refugees and that it's been like 10 years and that they're like on the same side now. It's kind of an interesting
That's
episode.
convoluted.
It's a little convoluted, but I like it. It's fun to watch, even if it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And in the end, like, you know, Degra ends up sort of turning to their side. At the very least, they are able to convince him that trusting the, you know, the sphere builders is not a good plan, which, you know, is not a terribly hard sell to make, honestly. And it's part, like, that's one of the things I appreciate about the Zindi arc is that it, because there are clearly the different Zindi have different objectives, and Degra sort of plays into that, where he is a villain, but he's not like necessarily in lockstep with all the other villains, which is, you know, it's easy to fall into that trap when you're writing a big, like, sprawling storyline of having all the villains just sort of, for some reason, on the same side.
Villains all just on the same side, so that's that just so that was kind of what the whole thing with Voyager we were talking about.
Yeah, basically. It was like, so Seska left, and so she had to join up with the Kazon because the Kazons were the villains for season one, but then, you know, that didn't really make a whole lot of sense for her character. But like with Degra, he's like working with the reptilians Indy, but he isn't like part of them, and he comes into conflict with them a fair bit. So, and they also with him, they go with kind of a like a Manhattan Project's vibe because he's a scientist and he's making like this giant weapon, so it's kind of hard to miss the parallels to like,
Yeah, it
you know.
felt like they were trying to go for a Robert Oppenheimer kind of thing, but again,
Yeah.
they kind of missed.
Well, I mean, I think they actually did it fairly well. Like, it's not perfect, it has some issues, but overall, like, you know, you do kind of get the sense of why this person who is not like a terrible monster would be willing to build such a devastating weapon. It's like, you know, he's been convinced that if he doesn't do this, his race will be wiped out. And granted, the motivation, the establishment of that is kind of weak. But you know, to a certain extent, they the Zindi do worship the sphere builders as gods. So you know, they have a reason to believe what they're saying. So you know, I think it like it works from the you know for and also it's interesting that Degra is one of the first villains in Enterprise, and maybe the first in Enterprise, who really gets like he gets his own screen time. Like, you know, we spend a fair amount of time with Degra just doing his thing, like when he's not directly confronting the main characters, which I think helped a lot. Like with Silic, we almost only ever see him when he's like in the middle of a mission and like trying to infiltrate something. So as a result, we didn't really have a whole lot of character growth.
And well, and Degra would, in a way, obviously there's other established or named characters, but at least to me, from the limited amount that I've seen it, and I've been meaning to rewatch, you know, all of the series, but especially the Zindi arc. But Degra would kind of be the standout character of the Zindi faction or council, right? I mean, obviously we had the one that was working on the bomb that Archer had to go tell him, "Hey, you're working on a bomb," and he didn't know it. But that was a cool thing that I liked about. It kind of confused me at first, but then when I, you know, looked into it more or just rewatched a little bit, the fact that the Zindi didn't all agree and have, you know, we're not on the same page all the time. Like they might have even had a similar goal, but then had different thoughts about how to accomplish it or different motivations and even sometimes differing goals or whatever. But so that was something that I thought was cool. But then like watching them, you know, bicker and disagree on their little council with the insect and the fish guy and all the others. But then Degra was the one that kind of stood out to me that like a lot of them were relying on him or just, you know, having to deal with him in one way or the other. So that was kind of a standout, character for the Zindi group for me when I was first watching through it.
I also appreciated how, like, because Dagro's not actually on the council, like, he's just, he's working with them a lot, and he sort of depends on them for resources. I appreciate the couple episodes where he's like, guys, here's this thing, and they're like, why isn't it done yet? And he's like, it's hard to do, it's science, and they're like, you need to get more science, and he's like, I need more stuff for more science, and they're like, we don't want to give you more stuff. And so, there's, it's like, not a huge part
More
of his
stuff for
character.
science.
More
Science stuff
stuff.
more of.
And there's that one episode where, like, they're saying, like, we need to make the giant planet-killing bomb, and he's doing, like, the almost like the MythBusters where they do the scaled-down test, like on miniatures and prototypes that are scaled down, and then see if those work first, and then we'll if those work, we'll work on the big one. It kind of just was a cool little thing about showing the process and him actually, like a nod towards him actually doing science about having to do tests and calculations and then retest it and, testing his theories and not just like, I made a bomb and now it's perfect, the first time I ever make it. It was just kind of interesting to see that. And then the timetable of the other Zindi, like, hurry up already, but he's having to, test levels and all that. So that was kind of cool seeing him do his science thing.
Now, as I recall, the there's like there's the there are a couple of other villains like from season four who show up more than once because season four was doing those like three episode arcs. But there's one more that I don't really remember very well, and David, maybe you'll remember him better. See, Enterprise actually established the character Duras, and he showed up a couple of times. I think he was eventually killed in like the beginning of season three. Now, do you remember like anything about him? Because I'm kind of drawing a blank, like trying to remember if he had any real defining characteristics at all.
Not really. I mean, that was another one that the Zindi arc was one, and the whole Klingon and the Duras stories were ones that I remember seeing the first time, and then wanting to go like, liking it or thinking well, that's interesting or that's odd. Like I want to see that again to know more about it, but I just haven't had the time, taken the time or the opportunity to do that. But I mean, that was just the fact that they did that to begin with. The father of the Duras that we see in TNG and the Duras sisters, to have him come back. He was in three episodes. It says he was in Judgment, Bounty, and The Expanse. So those are definitely some episodes I need to watch over again. Yeah, that's another one that I wanted to know more about. But what about the time guy, the guy that was always trying to like rewrite and correct
Oh.
and mess with time to get his
Yeah, so.
wife back or something?
Oh, wait, hang on. Who are you talking? I'm thinking of so I was thinking of Future Guy, who was that like weird blurry guy from
Yeah,
Enterprise that
yeah.
like the Suliban take orders from. The guy who's trying to get his wife back is from Year of Hell.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I got the two mixed up, but I was thinking of the blurry guy, the guy that was like from the future, and they kept talking to him about missions or acts or things that needed to be done or is it time yet or whatever. That whole thing just intrigued me because I think I missed part of those. I don't remember how many episodes he was in or that storyline went, but I think I missed some of it because I remember thinking like who is this guy? What's his deal? Like his motivation? What's he trying to accomplish? So, I mean, but that was one that, intrigued me enough that I want to go watch those episodes to find out what's going on with that guy.
Yeah, so he doesn't really we never really discuss him like at all. He's even called Future Guy on Memory Alpha 'cause he doesn't have a name. We never really found out like
Wow.
yeah, we never
They
really
really went
find
above
out.
and beyond planning this, didn't they?
Yeah, like what is he trying to do? We never find any of that out. We don't really know. And so there's not really a whole lot to talk about with him. He's like supposed to be like a mysterious guy, but because the temporal Cold War story in Enterprise is so like badly handled, we never really found out anything about him. And we probably know, I mean, there's I was trying to think, I'm like running through the list, like are there any other Enterprise ones? There's so there's Dolom, cause he's that reptilian guy from the Zindi arc. He does actually have a name. I had forgotten that he had a name. But again, he's sort of a generic like I'm here to shoot you kind of bad guy. He's like again, like Degra is the one who really gets all of the characterization. And like the only couple I can think of are like there are the Augments from season four, which again I don't think you've seen, Grace. I don't think you've seen far enough for that.
No, not really.
So we might have to talk. We'll definitely like. I think that we've pretty much covered all of the villains by this point. I think after 3 weeks we are finally done, guys. I think we've got them all. Congratulations.
Except for that one dude who, you know, was a Klingon and then wasn't a Klingon and then went back in time, you know, to, you know, trials and tribulations.
Arn Darvin.
Yeah, oh yeah, Arn Darvin. I guess he did technically show up more than once. Should have talked about him back on Deep Space Nine. Same actor even. I appreciated that a lot.
Right? Neat dude.
But all right, since we are effectively at the end of the show now, I have an important announcement to make. So everyone, listen up. We've been doing the show for a long time now, and it has been a whole lot of fun. But because of factors in real life, we are going to be ending All Things Trek at the end of November. So we have about, I think, 6 more shows left, and we will be doing some interesting stuff in November. We plan to go out with a bang and have, like, you know, end on a high note. So I just want everyone to know that. If you have any emails that you want to send that, like, you know, can coincide with the end of the show, our last show will be on November 29th. And like I said, we're planning some cool stuff between now and then. But I did not want this to come as a surprise because I want us to build up and end on a high note and not just, you know, not be one of those podcasts that's there 1 week and gone the next.
Yeah, and I remember listening, enjoying All Things Trek way before I even was a part of it, and, you know, over the course of this, the lifetime of it. One question I have that, you know, I haven't even brought up off air yet, but just to, you know, I'll ask here. But do you, even though the podcast will cease production, will the website stay up and episodes still be available to listen to if someone wants to go back and hear, you know, the beginning and older episodes and up to, you know, relive some of the current?
My plan is to keep them up for a while. Probably not forever, but, like, leave them up for at least a month or so, just, you know, in case anyone who's interested wants to see the rest. Otherwise, you know, once that happens, I'll probably take them down just because there's, you know, I don't want to keep paying for hosting that we're not using, but I'm definitely not going to take them down, like, immediately after our last episode. So people will have time if they want to listen to them. And of course, you know, if someone is really interested, they can always contact me because I'm not going to delete them. I'll still have them. So yeah, so that's my basic plan. But thank you everyone for listening to this show and for the and for sitting through my announcement. Thank you, David and Grace, for going through this 3-part discussion with me, and Grace in particular.
That's what we do.
We had to talk about some stuff you haven't seen yet. So
yeah, now I am the future guy.
Now you are future guy. So join us next week. We'll be doing a pre-recorded show because I have some stuff to do next Saturday, but there will be an episode of All Things Trek. You can tune in to hear it at the same time in the same channel. I'm not sure what it's going to be about yet. We'll think of something. And like I said, if you have any emails you want to send to us about the show and, you know, if anything in particular that stood out to you for as long as it's been going on, then please do that. AllThingsTrek@hotmail.com. Until then, this will be All Things Trek signing off.